Welcome to the Development Policy Centre. Taxation is central to the social contract between citizens and the state, yet little research has explored the relationship between individual attitudes towards this and perceptions of tax fairness or efficiency. In this podcast, entitled The Social Contract, Preferences for Redistribution and Tax Morale, chaired by Matthias Sinning of the Tax Policy Institute, you'll hear David Doyle of Oxford University and the ANU, and Jared McCarthy of the ANU. They discuss their use of experimental research with informal sector workers in Mexico. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matthias Sinning. I'm from the ANU Tax and Transport Policy Institute. I'm very happy to introduce the seminar speakers for today's joint seminar, Development Policy Center in the Tax and Transport Policy Institute. I just said to Stephen House we should do this more often and have joint seminars. The Tax Policy Institute here at the Crawford School does mainly do work on Australian tax policy issues, but we are trying to find interesting topics and interesting data sources that we can use in other countries as well. And should definitely think more about ways to work together and extend our work in other countries. Well, I'm happy to introduce today's speakers. We have a joint presentation by David Doyle and Gerard McCarthy. And they've told me, I think, David, you're going to go first and talk for about 25 minutes, and then about 20 minutes, and Gerard will have like 15 to 20 minutes. And then after that, we have about 20 minutes for questions and discussion. Just briefly introduce David. David Doyle is an associate professor of Latin American politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Oxford University. And his research interests include comparative politics and comparative political economy. He's working on a number of projects, including, for example, on the political economy of partisanship, taxation and spending in Latin America, and he's published widely in a range of outstanding journals, including like the American Political Science Review, Journal of Politics, British Journal of Political Sciences, and many others. And Gerard McCarthy is Associate Director of ANU's Myanmar Research Center, and a doctoral candidate in the Department of Political and Social and Societal Change. And his PhD thesis looks into the informal institutions and the contemporary social, political, and moral legacies of military rule in provincial Myanmar. Sounds like an amazing job. And he's consulted a range of agencies, including the International Growth Center Myanmar, United States Institute of Peace, the Carter Center, and Tech Change. So, welcome both, and the recorded this.
Thank you.
So, firstly, I'd just like to say thank you very much to the Tax Policy Institute here at the Crawford School of Public Policy and Development Policy Center, and to Jared for organizing this. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm absolutely delighted. This is my first time in Australia, and I have to say it's been absolutely wonderful. Canberra is an amazing city, and the campus is really beautiful. Although it's a little too hot, as you can see with my hairstyle. One has to be very careful, and I got that while running around the lake, which was a very pleasant run, but it was quite sore in the shower. So what I'm going to talk about today is a larger project that I'm working on with two colleagues and friends of mine at University College London, Nestor Castaneda Angarita and also Cassie Schwartz. And this project is a sort of a large exploration of what might generally or broadly be termed the social contract in Latin America. And we are specifically interested in two dimensions, both the macro level of the social contract, so the sort of state level or policy level aspect of the social contract. And what I'm going to show you today is the micro-level aspect of the social contract. Because if we think about the social contract, it's fundamentally predicated on a bargain that exists between political elites or the states and between individuals. So the state is going to become predatory. It's going to argue that it's going to extract resources from its citizens, but in return for these resources, it's going to provide very basic public goods, the most basic of which is security, and then all sorts of additional public goods on top of that. From a micro-level perspective, citizens have to willingly enter into this contract. They have to willingly agree to enter into this contract, and they willingly enter into this contract. Well, sometimes they are forced to do so, but in most cases, it's quasi-voluntary compliance. And when they agree to enter into this contract, they do so because they perceive that they are getting something in return from the state. So this kind of helps us to explain the dynamics of the social contract. And the project is really motivated by just the dynamic that has been occurring in Latin America over the last 20, 25 years or so. And this is the fact that what this just simply shows you here is that this is just changes in social spending year on year. And this just shows you here, across three different major regions, the average rate of income tax, and this is the average rate of VAT, or indirect taxation. And what this shows you is that over time across Latin America, we have been seeing a big increase year on year in social spending. So this has been quite aggressive. At the same time, what we've witnessed is a significant decrease in the average marginal income tax rate, and quite a significant increase in indirect, or what we might call value-added taxes. I'm not sure if that's what you call them here in Australia. So indirect or consumption taxes. And what some work that Nestor and I did earlier, what we showed is when we began to examine the dynamics of this process, we uncovered the fact that left-leaning governments in particular are very aggressive and have been over the last 20 years in expanding social welfare. So in Latin America, the welfare regime is highly regressive. It incorporates only a very narrow segment of society. And so governments, particularly left-leaning governments, have appealed to those who have been excluded from traditional welfare mechanisms and traditional welfare regimes by promising to move towards universalism, by offering things like universal pensions or universal healthcare, for example. But in order to fund this type of spending, and this type of spending has come with a notable electoral boon for these governments, in order to fund this type of spending, they have turned to indirect taxation. And for us, this is something of a contradiction, because indirect taxation or consumption tax tends to be quite regressive, particularly in the context of high inequality. Because what happens is that those at the bottom of the income spectrum are much more likely to spend a greater proportion of their income on goods relative to those at the higher end of the income spectrum. So this is a flat tax and it's quite regressive. So we have something of a contradiction here. On one hand, you have a movement towards a more progressive types of spending, yet to fund this spending, the other side of the coin, the fiscal side of the coin, is actually quite regressive. So in effect, they are nearly cancelling each other out. So we began a project investigating the dynamics behind what's going on across the region. And one aspect of this project has been to explore, why do citizens pay taxes? How do they approach this idea of the social contract? Are they aware, for example, that most of the taxation that's being implemented across the region is now indirect tax? Do they notice this? Do they care? Why is there such high rates of tax evasion across the region? What seems to explain such persistent levels of tax evasion? And what we discovered is that there's actually virtually no work or research has been done on the individual level determinants of tax evasion or willingness to pay tax, or what we might call tax morale in Latin America. There is very few studies. There's about four papers that have examined in any systematic way the individual determinants of tax morale in Latin America. So with some help from the British Academy and the Andean Development Bank, who are very keen to do this, we began a project investigating at the individual level some of these micro-level determinants. So we have a very broad brush argument that I'm just going to present very quickly because I don't have much time. And that is that we think this willingness to pay tax in Latin America is a function of what we call reciprocity. And that's an individual's belief that the government will provide some tangible public good in return for taxes, and it will do so efficiently and fairly. So this is the idea, or at least the core sentiment or the core fundamental tenet of this idea of the social contract, that they will pay taxes if they are going to receive something in return, or if they perceive that they are going to receive something in return. And what we show, actually, is that individual engagement in the social contract is driven by both self-interest and by perceptions of societal efficacy. So we make a distinction between two types of reciprocity. We make a distinction between egotropic reciprocity, you can actually see that at the top, and sociotropic reciprocity. I don't know how many of you are political scientists here in the audience, but some of you will be familiar with theories of economic voting. Theories of economic voting make this distinction between egotropic voting and sociotropic voting. Egotropic voting is when you vote just simply on the basis of how a government or how the economy performs relative to your wallet or pocketbook. Sociotropic voting is how it is how you vote based on how the economy performs relative to society as a whole. And we think there's a similar dynamic going on when it comes to the individual level and this willingness to pay tax, or this willingness to either pay tax or the desire to avoid taxation. And so what we argue is that the degree to which citizens believe that they will personally receive some type of reciprocal benefit in the form of a public good, that this will shape their willingness to pay taxation. And in order to, and it's not just simply about this bare bones calculation, they are also going to be thinking about how efficiently and successfully they believe the government can provide this public good relative to private providers. So let me give you sort of a concrete example. So some of you may have guessed by my accent that I'm not actually British. Maybe you haven't, but I'm not British. I'm Irish. But I live in the UK. When I moved to the UK, when I first moved to Oxford, I brought with me my private health insurance, because everybody has private health insurance in Ireland, or at least everybody in middle class, I should say. So when I arrived in the UK, I continued to pay for private health insurance. After a year, I realized that there was no marginal return for paying for private health insurance. The NHS is so good that there's just simply no point in doing so. So I just abandoned my private health insurance and then fully engaged with the social contract. Now, in the context of the UK, I can't evade taxes, or at least I don't think Oxford University would look too favorably upon me if I did. But in other contexts, in somewhere like Latin America, where a big proportion of economic activity is in the informal sector, it is actually quite easy to evade taxes. And so what we argue is that individuals will make these types of calculations. And more formally, what we could say is that if the individual marginal utility derived from paying tax in return for state-provided public goods is greater than not paying a tax and paying a private provider for this good, well then, tax morale is going to be high. So if an individual believes that it's worth paying a tax, and that the benefit that you accrue from paying a tax is greater than the benefit that you would get from paying some private provider for this same good, well then, tax morale is going to be high. And this is a real viable option for Latin American citizens. And in fact, it's not just, but this extends to things like welfare benefits, it extends to things like education, to health, to pensions, but also even into the realm of public security. So for example, what you frequently see in Latin America is middle-class estates who have just simply pay for their own private security services. So these types of decisions are a real viable option for Latin American citizens. But we also suggest there's a sociotropic element, and that is that tax morale is shaped by beliefs and attitudes about fairness and about redistribution. And that is that in Latin America, there, because of the particular nature of the evolution of the welfare state, which came about during a period of import substitute industrialization, and in 20 minutes, I just can't explain that and everything else, and what this means is that the welfare regimes across the region are quite regressive. They are targeted at very narrow groups within society, and these groups tend to be in the upper quadrants of, or in the upper sections of the income deciles. So they tend to be skilled laborers, they tend to be white-collar government workers, and what this means, for example, in a country like Guatemala or a country like Honduras, is that about 60 or 70% of those in the top income decile are covered by state pensions, and only about 4% of those in the bottom decile are covered by state pensions. So these are very regressive types of tax systems, and are very regressive types of welfare regimes. And so what we argue is that the degree to which individuals believe that the taxes are used for community welfare or for improving society as a whole will also shape their tax morale. So that is the degree or the perception of progressivity that individuals have. And we have some evidence from outside Latin America, in the US and the UK, that this perception of progressivity is really important for how willing people are to pay tax, or how satisfied people are in paying taxes in return for some type of public good or some type of publicly funded redistribution. So therefore, more formally again, willingness to pay taxes depend on their views about the welfare state. If citizens perceive that the government is affected in implementing social and poverty alleviation policies rather than targeting narrow specific groups, then again, tax morale will be high. So the more progressive that you think the system is, the more likely you are to engage in or become more willing to pay tax. And so therefore, we expect simply that when this egotropic reciprocity is greater and citizens believe they receive a tangible benefit from the social contract, tax morale will be higher. And likewise, when the sociotropic reciprocity is greater, when they have this progressive image of tax-funded redistribution, tax morale will be higher. Okay, so that was, in a very quick nutshell, the general sense or the general argument at a micro level. So how do we go about testing this? Well, what we realize is that this is actually a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to empirically try to validate. So what we realized after sort of looking at different types of public opinion surveys, looking at different sources of data, is that we're going to have to go to the field and collect this data ourselves. So what I'm going to show you today is just the results from one of our experiments. So what we do are large public survey experiments, and I'll explain exactly how these experiments work. And the one I'm going to show you today is a survey that we ran in Mexico City. So it's a representative sample of citizens of Mexico City. We've just repeated the survey in Bogotá, and we hope then to extend it to Quito, to Lima, and also maybe to Brazil, but none of us speak Portuguese, as I was explaining to Jared, so that's somewhat of a barrier. So we think Mexico City is a good case to actually test our theories, primarily because it represents a difficult case. So in Mexico, tax morale is really, really low. So the tax revenue is only about 17.4% of GDP, and over the last 20 years, tax revenue has only grown by about 4 percentage points. So it's really low, and it's pretty static. When it comes to the OECD, Mexico is the ranks lowest in terms of the tax to GDP ratio, and it has one of the lowest tax burdens, not just among OECD countries, but among its compatriots across the region also. Tax evasion is a major problem. So income tax evasion among individuals is about 15 to 20%. And this figure is quite important. So remember this figure, so I'll come back to it. Among small firms, most of whom operate in the what we call the informal sector. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this idea of the informal sector, but I can explain more maybe in the Q&A. That tax evasion among those small firms is about 80%. So it's over 80%. Corporate tax, so this is registered, institutionalized, large corporate firms, tax evasion is about 25%, and VAT evasion, so people avoiding consumption tax, is about 20%. And just to give you some sense of what this cost to the Mexican state, in 2005 alone, VAT evasion cost the Mexican state $1.3 billion. So this is, and that's just for VAT alone. So this has a significant effect on the fiscal capacity of the Latin American state, which is obviously endogenous then to their ability to provide public goods. And when we look at data from individuals, and this just comes from an off-the-shelf public opinion survey called LAPOP, which is run out of Vanderbilt, what we see is that people have a very distrustful attitude of the state. 83% of citizens think corruption is a problem. About over half of citizens have little trust or any trust at all in the government, and only 8% actually believe the government can adequately fight corruption. So what we have is an environment of large-scale tax evasion where the individual-level citizens within that state have very or perceive or accord the state very little legitimacy with regards to any type of contractarian bargain. So what do we do? Well, with the help of a survey firm called Beltrán Juárez y Asociados, we conducted a representative sample of 1,100 face-to-face interviews representing all colonias or neighborhoods in Mexico City, and we collected this data in May 2017, so just at the start of the last summer, such that it is. And we measure these different types of theories in different ways. So when it comes to egotropic reciprocity or self-interest, we just use a measure, this is an AMI index, it's widely used in Mexican society among Mexican pollsters. We use a measure of education, employment status, so employed or unemployed. And then we also have a measure to determine whether individuals have access or pay for private insurance or whether they're in the state sector. So Mexico is a mixed system, so people can make a choice to either self-select into the state system or self-select into the private system. So we ask our respondents whether they're in the private or public system. I can explain a bit more about that. We have a question for sociotropic reciprocity. It's not great, but unfortunately the survey is now over, so there's nothing we can do about it. And this just simply asks, to what extent do you believe the government spends money trying to help the poor? So it's trying to get at this idea of progressivity. So how much do you believe that the government is actually using this money to help the poor? We have an attitude towards redistribution, so one specifically about inequality, and that is the very standard question. The gap between the income of the bottom 90 and the population of the top 1% is too large, and also meritocracy, or the idea that you can succeed in Mexican society regardless of any type of structural barriers. And this one is economic success is due to your family social status. And we also ask about peer effects because some previous studies have shown that the peer compliance is quite important. So the extent to which you think others are paying tax will motivate you to pay tax also. So if you tell you that your family or your neighbors are also paying tax, then you're much more likely to pay tax as well. So the issue, of course, is that when it comes to measuring tax morale, we often measure them through lab experiments or gains within the lab, and there's an issue of external validity here. So to what extent can we actually begin to generalize above and beyond something that happens in a lab with 40 students in a university somewhere? And when we ask people whether they evade tax in direct survey items, they actually don't really tell us the truth. This is what's called social desirability bias. In the UK, we have a problem called the shy UKIPper, And this is when you ask people, did you vote for UKIP? And they'll say, no, of course not. When actually they did vote for UKIP, but they're just too embarrassed to tell the enumerator that they actually did so. And so when it comes to tax preferences, what we find is that social desirability bias can either underreport bad behavior or overreport good behavior. So people tend to say that even if they do evade tax, they tend to claim that they wouldn't, simply because they don't want to appear bad in front of the enumerator, or else, even if they don't, or even if they do evade tax, they tend to, or even if they don't evade tax, they tend to say, or they wouldn't even consider evading tax, they tend to say that they would support redistribution, and they would of course pay tax, because again, they want to present this image of being socially desirable to the enumerator. So we know this is a problem. And so in order to get over this, we use something called list experiments. I don't know if anybody's familiar here with list experiments. So list experiments, as far as we are aware, this is the first time that anybody has used these list experiments in order to try and ascertain or get at a tax, specifically at tax morale. So they're used a lot when it comes to clientelism. A colleague of mine at Oxford, Ezequiel González Ocampos, has done a lot of work in Central America examining how list experiments are a very good way of trying to ascertain whether someone truly sells their vote or not. So how does this work? A list experiment is really, really simple. We take our 1,100 people, and we split them into a control group and a treatment group. They're randomly assigned. So we have 550 in one, 550 in the other. Totally random assignment. Then what we do is we ask our control group, here's a list of three things that people do to save money. Spend less money on groceries each week, steal some money, or look for an additional job. This one is in here because we want to avoid what's called floor or ceiling effects. We don't expect people to actually pick this option. We give them a card with those options listed on the card, and we don't ask them to tell us which ones they would do, we just ask them to tell us how many of these they would choose. So they just simply tell us they would do two of these things or one of these things. The treatment group gets the exact same question and the exact same list, except they get one more item. And this item is that they would not pay their taxes. And what we then do, again, we just give them the card and they tell us how many of these things they would do. So for example, here we might expect them to choose two or one, and in the treatment group, we might expect them to choose two or three. And what you then do is you just subtract the average number of responses from the control group, from the treatment group, and that's the average treatment effect in your sample population. So it's a really, really neat and efficient way of getting at something like tax evasion or the willingness to avoid taxes without actually asking anybody directly that particular question. We also have a question about redistribution. So that is, here's a list of programs that the government could invest if they increase taxes. You'd have to pay more for goods or would receive less money in income for the increase in taxes. And we have three things: a program that would attract foreign companies, a program to improve maths classes, a program to pay for the wall proposed by Donald Trump. And this obviously is the one that we don't expect people to pick. And then we have a treatment group, which again is the exact same, except we add this fourth option here, a program to help the poorest Mexicans purchase a car. And these are two separate experiments. So the sample is randomized for this one, and the sample is again randomized for this one. So these are two very separate experiments. So they're a way to try and get at is what is the average treatment effect within these societies. So, very quickly, the results. This just shows you the results of the tax evasion list experiment. I'm not going to go through it in any great detail, but what this shows us is that the difference between the control group and the treatment group is about 17.5%. And this effect is really highly statistically significant. So what this tells us is about 17.5% of citizens in Mexico City would avoid paying taxes. They would evade taxes. And that's a pretty accurate reflection of what we think reality is. And if you remember at the beginning, the official state estimates are tax evasion of about 15 to 20%. So we were really happy with this because we were bang on the official estimates. So we think this is a very nice way of measuring tax evasion. Interestingly, if we look at the willingness to engage in some type of redistributive funded tax, or some type of tax that will fund redistribution, it's only about 6%, and this effect is just not statistically significant. So people just weren't willing to pay a tax, even if it goes towards some form of redistribution, but the question is not perfect, and I can talk a little bit about that. We also then model these in linear models. I'm not going to show you what these are, but just the major results is that those who pay for private insurance are much more willing to evade tax than others. So for us, that makes a lot of sense because you've opted out of the social contract. You've made a conscious decision not to opt into the state system. You've made a conscious decision to opt into the private system, and therefore you are making this egotropic calculation about the marginal return from private providers versus some type of publicly funded redistribution. And we also show in really interesting, but the same people who said they would evade taxes with private insurance, and so that's about 22 to 27% of those with private insurance would evade taxes, which is much higher than the average treatment effect, they would also be willing to pay a tax if they thought it was progressive. So these are the major statistically significant results that we have. So they would evade taxes, all else equal, but if they thought the tax was much more progressive and was going towards redistribution, they would actually be willing to pay taxes. So they would opt back in if they thought the tax system was better. And there is some evidence of reciprocity here. Unsurprisingly, those who believe the government is much more progressive in its policies are more willing to pay taxes. But there's an issue. And the issue here is about how do we get political sciences are obsessed with something called causal identification. So how do we actually identify what's going on here? Because it's quite possible that attitudes towards inequality are going to be confounded by your attitudes towards reciprocity. So you might think actually that the state is doing a great job when it comes to reciprocity, and therefore the state is really good at tackling inequality, but these two things are going to be confounded simply because of your own private experience of receiving some type of tax. So what we try to do is to disentangle this mechanism. And so what we now have is what's called a list experiment embedded in a primary experiment. So we take the same people, I mean, they were getting tired at this stage, but we take the same people and we randomize them into three groups. So we randomize them into three different groups, and each group we then perform another list experiment, and I'll show you exactly what we mean. So what we do is we randomize them into three groups. We tell them, we ask them this question: suppose that the government, federal government, was going to build a new road in either Mexico City, that's group one, so that's going to be our comparison group, in the elegant area of Santa Fe, which is the wealthiest district of Mexico City, or in the poorest district, the well-known poorest district of Mexico City, Tlahuac, that the government is going to build a road in this area. So we have group one, is the Mexico City in general, group two is Santa Fe, and group three is Tlahuac, which is the poorest area of the city. And then what we do is we ask them how likely they think the government is they're going to finish the road on time, and how likely it is that politicians will pocket a good part of the money. And then we take each one of those three groups and then we split them into two again, into a control and treatment group, and we perform another list experiment. And here we tell them that these are things that the government could do to raise the money they need to build the road, impose a tax on big companies and business, seek foreign investment, build a road with low quality and unsafe materials, which is the one that we don't expect anybody to choose. So that's what the control gets, and the treatment then gets this question as well, which is impose a small tax on all residents of Mexico City. So what are our results? Well, our results are really interesting. That respondents were willing to pay a tax if it was going to build a road in Mexico City in general, or to build a road in the poor area. But it was really quite striking that no one wanted to build a road in the rich area. It was amazingly striking. Independent of income, education, wealth, no one was willing to pay for a road in the rich area. So what this shows us, or at least what we infer from this, is that there's low support for tax in general, but people are unequivocally opposed to paying taxes if they believe that the benefits will go to the rich. This is a really, really strong effect. So they will just simply be unequivocally opposed to any type of taxation if they think it's going to fund the rich, which is often the common perception of taxation across the region of Latin America. And even more interestingly, when we look at the linear estimates, respondents were still willing to pay for a road in a poor area, even if they thought the politicians were going to steal some of that money. Even those who thought the money was going to be stolen were still willing to pay for that tax if they thought some of that money was going to be was going to help build that road in that poor area. So just to finish off very quickly, well, we think it's all about this ecotropic and sociotropic perspectives on taxation. Individuals who opt out of the social contract are just going to be less willing to pay a tax, but at the same time, they would re-engage if they thought the tax system was much more progressive. And what we also show is that a willingness to pay this redistributive tax increases as perceptions of progressivity increase. So how do we interpret all of this? Well, we believe that individuals in Mexico City, they are unwilling to pay taxes. And this is quite important, not because they believe that the money will be spent unwisely or because the politicians will squander the money targeted to the poor. This is not the case, but because they believe the money is not actually spent on the poor. So it's not about their perception that the politicians are going to steal it, it's corrupt, or that the application or this type of redistributive spending is really inefficient. It's because they believe that politicians just don't spend this money on the poor. And if they did spend it on the poor, well, then they'd be much more willing to engage in this type of social contract. So finally, we think the degree to which, and this of course is what the Andean Development Bank is very interested in, how then, given these findings,
how then do you actually begin to re-engage people into the social contract, given the huge levels of tax evasions that exist? And we think it's not just about how effectively the state delivers public goods and how progressive it actually does this, but it's about getting that information to the citizens as well. It's about letting people know that they are engaging in this, that where their tax funded, where their taxes actually go. So it's about, we think part of it is about letting the individuals know, or the citizens know, where their taxes actually go. So if you pay a tax in Mexico, where does it go, and is it progressive? I think the state, we have some evidence in some other work that if the state does this, again, people are much more willing to re-engage in the social contract. We also show that all taxes are not equal. I'm not going to do that here, but we have another set of experiments, which are what we call conjoint analyses. And what this showed us is people's preferences for different tax structures. So do you make a cost-benefit analysis about different types of taxation? So do you think about income tax? Do you think about VAT? Do you weigh the two of them up together? And what we show is that income tax has a heavier cognitive load for individuals. And what we mean by that is that they just don't realize they're paying it. And they don't actually realize or are able to a lot of individuals don't actually understand that they are paying an indirect taxation. They're just not aware that it exists. Whereas if you take money from someone's salary or from someone's income, they are much more clearly aware of what's going on. And as I said, we've just done it in Bogota, and we're going to do it lots of other places. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Thanks so much to the Debt Policy Centre and to the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute for hosting this seminar. From the outset, I should say this is a slice of my larger dissertation, which looks at regressive redistribution in the context of democratisation and why a regressive social welfare regime continues in Myanmar despite the transition to civilian rule since 2011. And as a consequence, this study is not identical. It's not looking at exactly the same methodological approach, nor the same questions, but very similar findings to similar kinds of probing about egotropic and sociotropic reciprocity and motivations to pay tax. So I'll give you a quick overview to the study, walk you through the research findings, and then I'll talk a little bit, building out of David's discussion, about kind of what are the options when we think about tax and redistribution to try and construct or cultivate a perception of the social contract. Just a bit of context, very similar to Mexico, Myanmar is the lowest. Has the lowest tax revenue of any country in Southeast Asia, and has done for a very long time, persistently below of hovering around 5%. And there's been a slight increase since the political transition in 2011 to around 7.5%. So that's over half, or under half, of what Mexico's overall tax revenue is as a percentage of GDP. The second major aspect of Myanmar's context that's important to keep in mind here is that you have very strong private, so commercial private providers, as well as charitable providers of a range of welfare services. And I'll come back to that in a second once I've had a discussion about taxation. So in order to try and understand, my larger dissertation is mixed methods. I spent a year and a half in provincial Myanmar doing largely qualitative, largely ethnographic and interview work with welfare groups, but also fielded this survey to try and understand variations in perceptions about the state and the responsibilities for welfare. So there's three key aspects that I think link quite clearly to David's discussion and to this larger discussion about the social contract that come out in this study. The first is how perceptions of tax morale varies according to a reliance on state versus non-state providers of welfare. Second is, how does the receipt of government development programs impact your assessment of tax morale? And the third is, how does your past experience of conflict ongoing experience of mixed administration impact your perceptions of tax morale. So I should say this research was funded by the International Growth Center Myanmar from a very generous grant, which we fielded this survey in March 2016. So this was a 1,000 household survey in Central East Myanmar, and it combined a household level socioeconomic survey looking at social protection and provision of social welfare, as well as tax and a range of other variables, with an individual within household socio-political survey looking at tax morale. And just to separate out that sample a little bit, those 1,000 households were divided between two areas of Central East Myanmar, a lowland area which has no history of conflict since the end of the colonial period and independence, and an upland area where there was conflict ongoing, escalating in the 1950s, then running through till a ceasefire that was signed in 2012. So a large part of that township where we did the survey was under a mixed administration or sole ethnic armed group administration until 2012, and government and ethnic armed group administration continues in some of these areas of that township. So overall, the sample, which is 1,000, was split between 500 between those two townships. Within that, 400 of those households were in urban wards and 600 were in rural areas. So again, that rural sample was split again. So that rural sample, we looked at 300 households in rural areas, which were receiving what was called a Green Emerald Rural Development Program from the Department of Rural Development in Myanmar. And we looked then at 300 households in non-treatment villages within the same village group. So as close as you could get, but not receiving that same government scheme. And that government scheme's been running since 2013. So it's been running for a couple of years by the time that we fielded this survey. So that's just an indication of the, when I say upland, lowland, the green left area is the lowland area of central Myanmar, which is the major artery north-south in the country. And then the right township is a mountainous sort of post-conflict, or ceasefire context where there is still remaining very strong ethnic armed group. So overall, just headline, we found that state tax in terms of as a proportion of household expenditures comprises about 3.7% overall of household expenditures across the sample. And we found that this was only slightly higher in the upland conflict area. But this is also partly due to larger agricultural plots, but also taxation by the ethnic armed group in that area. Interestingly, we found a very weak sense of egotropic motivation. So a very strong association across the sample that tax provides services or pays for the provision of welfare. And so we see particularly strong contrasts between the conflict area, where we see 56% of respondents who said that tax is nothing but a duty. So we asked them to identify what is the best description of taxation. Is it a duty, so something that's done out of coercion because you're told to be done so by an authority? Is it a payment for services, or is it a donation to support the welfare of others? And we see, as you can see in the data, a very weak link with the idea of welfare or the provision of services. And this is an even weaker connection in upland ceasefire areas. Interestingly, though, we see that provision and receipt of state assistance boosts tax morale. So we find that respondents who have received state assistance from government maternal clinics, for example, were about 13% more likely to say that tax was a payment for services provided by the state. So we see that this idea that services, as we've been talking about, this egotropic motivation to pay tax is borne out in our data as well. When you receive government services, you're more likely to say that tax provides, is linked to some kind of provision of services. More broadly, though, there's a very strong perception in our sample that tax is unfairly levied. 46% of respondents said, almost half, said tax was not fairly levied. And how we got at this question was asking people, does everyone in this area pay what they are due, or are some people able to avoid taxation? Only 21% of respondents said that that it was fairly levied. So we see tax unfairness, interestingly, a perception of tax unfairness, then correlating very strongly with a weak perception of tax legitimacy, or the right of the government to tax. And so a perception of unfairness is eroding the sociotropic motivations. The idea that that tax is being fairly levied is eroding the broader legitimacy of the state to tax. Interestingly, when we get to these questions about redistribution and the efficacy of the state in redistribution, we see that a half of people say that tax is not redistributed effectively to those who need it most. Interestingly, we see that this is stronger. The idea that we don't know where tax goes is about 8% stronger in the upland area, the conflict area, than in the lowland area. When we look at fairness of redistribution, so this is about a perception that is it fair that tax that's collected locally is spent elsewhere in the country? So we're getting at these questions again of sociotropic motivations, this willingness to pay a tax that benefits others. Half said that it was fair for taxes to be redistributed elsewhere in the country. But this sociotropic motivation was much weaker in the conflict area, where about 14% were 14% more likely to say that tax should only be spent in the local area. So we can have a longer discussion, if you like, in the Q&A about legacies of conflict, absence of services, and how these shape those and bear out our data. But interestingly, we see redistribution fairness correlates with efficacy. So the sociotropic motivations are much stronger when the state is judged as an effective redistributor. So it's fair to pay tax when you feel like there is someone benefiting, someone in elsewhere in the country who's in need, who's benefiting. So just to take a step back, we've been talking a lot about tax. I want to contrast this a little bit with donations, which what we found was twice as big in terms of the financial burden of households than outlays on taxation. It accounted for about 8% of household expenditures were to social and religious groups that were providing a range of social and economic goods. We find, interestingly, that when we ask exactly the same questions about donations as we did about tax, and we found very, very different responses. We found very strong confidence in the efficacy of donations, that they were redistributed to where they were needed most, and a very strong willingness, much stronger than taxation, as over 70% across various variables, that people were willing to give a donation that it was fair for that donation to be redistributed elsewhere in the country. So very strong sociotropic motivations, but also linked to a faith that donations are effectively redistributed elsewhere in the country. So we see confidence in redistribution correlating very strongly with sociotropic motivations. So we see fairness and efficacy, again, closely linked, but with the empirically total reverse reality of what you see with taxation. So just a few options when we take a step back and think about how do we construct and cultivate a stronger sense of a fiscal social contract. So the first option is that you could simply expand state services without collecting more taxes. What we see in our data is that there is a very clear but isolated impact on tax morale when you do this. So rural development villages, the ones that I told you about that receive the government development initiatives, which is loans at a household level, households that received these schemes were about 12% more confident that their taxes were effectively redistributed elsewhere in the country compared with the control villages, which didn't receive that intervention. So that's quite a substantial impact on perceptions of tax effectiveness. But interestingly, we see absolutely no variation when we look at tax fairness, so and this right of the state to levy taxes. So the idea of sociotropic motivation being developed by expanding state services is not borne out in our data. What we see is that when people receive government services, they feel that they're getting a benefit individually from state from paying taxes, but they don't feel like it's being effectively levied on everyone who should pay taxes, and they don't feel it's being redistributed effectively. And that erodes people's perceptions of the right to tax. So we don't see any tax fairness impact of providing and expanding services. So another option would be to simply apply strong coercion in the provision and collection of tax. And this is by far the dominant approach in Myanmar, with an emphasis on fines for failing to collect, failing to pay tax, as well as a very strong ideological emphasis, especially within the new government, on duty, and the emphasis which carries with it authoritarian kind of dimensions to it, right? That, you know, the authorities told you to do something and you have to give those funds. And what we find is that coercion may be a necessary aspect of encouraging a stronger notion of the social contract, but it is certainly insufficient. So egotropic and sociotropic motivations are mutually reinforcing, and identifying tax solely as a duty, for example, significantly increases the likelihood of saying tax is unfairly levied. So we see that egotropic and sociotropic motivations need to be linked. So a third option, one which has a much broader institutional discussion, is the reform of taxation and the public communications around taxation, as well as the expansion of services. So we see, that we see with donations, for example, that there is strong sociotropic motivation to pay an amount of money when it is redistributed elsewhere in an effective fashion. We see that with donations. We see a direct comparison. The issue is that the faith in the state as a competent institution of redistribution is absent. And one of the major aspects of this discussion in the context of Myanmar and in many other contexts is the distance from which the tax is collected and where decisions about redistribution are made. So in the context of Myanmar, which remains a highly centralized state in terms of levying taxes and making decisions about budgets, discussions about federalism and subnational governance are very big in these discussions about the social contract. We see, for example, very strong in the qualitative dimensions of this research, very strong association between paying tax and a fear that actually the military will benefit, because I don't know where my taxes goes. It just levies up all the way up to Naypyidaw, which is the capital of Myanmar, and it might end up benefiting the generals, and I just don't know. So the lack of transparency is linked to the distance from where decisions are made, and so looking at the powers of subnational governments around taxation and redistribution and decision-making is an important part of this. Linked to that discussion is the need to demonstrate directness. So showing a tangible outcome associated with paying tax, and subnational governments, again, with greater power to make and shape budgetary decisions, would be able to demonstrate that tangibility. But more broadly, an ideological change is required to move away from an emphasis on duty and coercion to emphasising what is the outcome and impacts of taxation. So one way in which you could do that is to partner with the civil society groups, the community-based organisations at a local level who are collecting donations in which people have significant faith that they're being effectively redistributed. Enlist them into roles in oversight, into roles in even the collection of taxation is one idea that we'd heard from some of the people we'd done briefings with in Myanmar. So thinking creatively about how you can the state can piggyback off the legitimacy that non-state actors hold in redistribution may be one option and one way in which to cultivate greater faith in taxation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 10 to 15 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Matthias. I have a question for both presenters. They were very interesting, and since David and I work on experiments, I get the first question at you. You talk about the fact that your experiment is, I'm interested in the embedded experiment. I have the question about non-respondents. Mm-hmm. What kind of non-respondents rate, what respondent participation bias you may have seen. I'm curious about the population for each of the three embedded questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a question about this, which I think is the most interesting. Given that your question is set up as a one-shot, at a one-shot, I'm very willing to let my money slip through the leaky bucket. But in a repeated game, it's going to be quite different. So I was just curious about how you're treating that interpretation. And for Jared, I have the same question about non-respondent bias, if you're concerned about non-respondent bias. I'm very thrilled about the fact that coercion doesn't work. But of course, my question is, how did you test that? Essentially, is it the question of coercion not working, or is it the question of monitoring not working? Because if you monitor badly, then surely coercion doesn't work. I guess the question I really have to is, are these open-ended questions for respondents? Thank you.
So, just to tackle the first question, we had no non-responses. And so we had no non-responses. We had non-responses for some of the demographic questions. So when we asked people which political party, for example, we didn't get an answer. And when we asked people about, for example, some issues about their income, we were interested in their position in the labor market, we got some non-responses. But for all the experimental questions, we didn't get any non-responses. Partly I think that's because for the participants, they just didn't, we explained, so this is part of our deal with Beltran and Asociados, that we had gone out there, we trained their enumerators, we were out there for 2 weeks training their enumerators, and part of the process was that we wanted to maximize, our responses on the list of terms. So if anybody was unwilling to do those, well, then they would sample someone else for us. As a consequence, we have full samples when it comes to the list experiments. But some of the individual demographic questions, we had a no answer or not sure, we had to do that. But they answered all the questions on the survey. So we didn't actually, people weren't, so it was a face-to-face survey. So that's what helps, right? So we had it all done on iPads. We had people going to houses. We used a representative sample based on a sampling frame, which is widely used in Mexican political opinion research. So we just borrowed their sampling frame. So it's face-to-face. So there's that strong self-selection effect. If you agree to do the survey, you're kind of in for the long haul, as it were. And so everybody answered every question, but we did allow people to say no answer or no response for specific questions. And when it came to everything is purely randomized, and it's randomized, so we use something called Qualtrics, which is, as I'm sure you're familiar with, which is a software specifically designed for these types of experiments. And so we allowed the Qualtrics to randomize the samples. So the enumerators had nothing to do with the randomization. We just simply inputted that this is what we wanted to do. So every single experiment is randomized. Now, whether it's perfectly randomized or not, I mean, we have some balance statistics, which shows us that, at least in the list experiments, there's quite a good balance in the list experiments in terms of demographic characteristics. Of course, when you then end up with, you split your sample into three, and then you split each one of those samples into a further two, obviously you lose some of that balance. I mean, it's just not going to be as perfectly balanced as you might anticipate. It's still fully, entirely randomized. So we randomized the split into three different groups. And then on top of that, we randomized the split into two of each one of those three different groups. So we effectively ended up with six randomized separate groups. One getting the Mexico City, one getting the rich area, one getting the poor area, and then a group within each one of those groups getting the treatment or the control. So perfectly randomized. And you know, we did all these tests that you can do on these types of experiments, and according to the statistics, I mean, take from that what you will, that we had no major design effects, or there was no issues with the randomization of the sample. But obviously, balance isn't perfect as you can drill down the lower you go. And that second part is really just to kind of get at some of the mechanisms more than anything. So does that answer your question?
And the population?
Oh, the population. So the sample population is a representative sample of individuals living in Mexico City. And as I said, we used 1,100 to start with. Yeah, and we used the sampling frame, which was, as I said, used by Beltran y Asociados. So they do a lot of this type of work in Mexico City. And so we tried to get it as representative. And given, I mean, if you compare our sample with the actual demographics of the city, it's pretty close. It's a pretty good split.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think there were two questions, one about non-response and one about duty or coercion.
One is methodological, one is theoretical.
Yeah, so on non-response, so we did a very similar approach to survey as did David. Randomized at various levels, and then it was the interview, it was about an hour and 10 minutes, and we got very low non-response rates. And there were some higher rates of don't know questions about some of those questions, but not these questions about taxation. We didn't have over, for example, 10%. So I think it was less than about 5% who said that they didn't know or didn't want to give an answer. So it wasn't a big methodological issue. The question about coercion, we got it that one of the ways that's borne out is that there's a very strong association between identifying tax as nothing but a duty and the idea that tax is unfair. So basically in Burmese, the idea of a duty carries with it very authoritarian dimensions that basically you have to do something because the authority has directed you to do so. But it's there are risks of violence or at least some non-violent coercive dimension to it. So the question about open-ended, how they define that, it wasn't an open-ended question. We asked them to say, here's three options about three ways that you can identify and define taxation. Please choose the best one or choose don't know. And we got no don't knows, very, very few don't knows, insignificant, and everyone chose one of those three. Does that make sense? You're a bit puzzled. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks both for a seminar for the year. And I'll just ask one question to give others time. I thought, David, for the Mexico study, you present evasion very much as something people either choose to do or choose not to do based on their attitudes to the state and their role in the state. But, of course, it's also a function of the opportunity to evade. If I'm a public servant, I'm just on a single income, tax is probably withheld. I can't evade. Whereas if I'm working as a small trader, somewhere in the informal sector, it is very much a choice I make. And then given that, I'm probably going to internalize. At least if I'm a public servant, I'm probably going to think I'm doing the right thing by paying tax. If I'm a trader, I think, why should I be paying tax? It's all waste anyway. So, yeah, I just wondered whether you were able to control for that. And if you're not, how does that...
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, our initial motivation for this study was about the difference between those in the formal sector and those in the informal sector. So we wanted to see whether your position in the labour market fundamentally changes your attitudes towards these things. So we have questions. We're able to map. We ask questions about the nature of people's employment contracts. So we're able to map whether people are in the informal sector or formal sector. And there is no big difference, actually. These results are controlling for things like occupation, whether you're in the informal sector or the formal sector, your wealth, etc., your income. So there is no major difference. And part of the reason, I think, is because tax evasion is not just simply at the income level. I think you're right. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. But in Mexico City, tax evasion is also at the consumption level. And so people do have this choice every day in some respects, whether you're in the informal or formal sector, whether to buy something on the black market or do you buy something in the formal sector market. I mean, I think there's a slight effect. So if you're in the formal sector, you're just less likely to evade taxes. And I think that's exactly the type of dynamic that you're talking about. One of the things we'd like to do is to start trying to interact some of our results with these differences. So do we see, for example, less of a willingness to evade taxes depending on your type of employment contract? I mean, and I think that would speak to what you're saying. We just haven't done it yet, but I think it's quite plausible. I would anticipate that that's what we should see, because I do think the opportunity differs. But it is also a choice that I think is available to nearly everybody in the city. Even if you go there, I mean, you make the choice yourself, just even there yourself.
Chris? Yeah, thank you both for your presentations. Really interesting. So I guess my question comes down to what extent were you able to capture people's beliefs about whether they were sort of a net beneficiary or a net contributor to the sort of tax and transfer system? And the extent to which that could be shaping their answers in regards, for the results.
So, at least in the context of our study, and this one, I mean, the only way we really got at that was whether they are in the the public system, so the public healthcare system. And there's about four different public healthcare systems that you can select into. And for us, this was the only way that we could really... We have changed this for the subsequent surveys because we really wanted to get, as our kind of theory evolved a bit, we really wanted to get at this marginal trade-off. But here, we're just really got forced to rely on this proxy, which is a proxy and not a very good one, admittedly. But at least it does give us some sense that if you're in the private system, if you self-select into the private system, you probably have made that marginal calculation that you're better off in the private system than you are in the public system. And it's a proxy, but I mean, unfortunately, we made lots of errors in this experiment. This is our first one, but we're learning. So,
that's a good question.
I'm just wondering if you considered the ethical implications of this sort of research. To some extent, the citizens' concern that their taxes are going to the generals is fairly legitimate, perhaps less so in the case of Mexico. Are you concerned that you're essentially helping the regime come up with marketing slogans to collect more tax without consideration of where it's going?
It's an interesting question. I think if you asked that question 10 years ago, then that would be accurate. But the way in which the constitutional arrangements in Myanmar are set up at present is that the ministries of finance and planning, for example, are run by civilians. There are major ministries that are continued to be controlled by generals, so immigration, border affairs, and defence. But the major social protection ministries and Internal Revenue Department, for example, all controlled by civilians. So that kind of statement about, you know, it might go to the generals is a legacy statement, right? It's look, I don't really know where the money is going, and I haven't ever known in my lifetime. And, you know, in my experience, generals probably are pocketing money. The reality is that the purse strings and budgeting of at least the civilian budget is controlled by civilians. It's the ethical concerns, I think, are much bigger about seeing this data and not, trying to find a tangible way in which to expand state services and provision of welfare. Because, I mean, that's the reality of what you see in this sample, right, which is that people are overwhelmingly self-reliant, are relying on precarious and patchy, safe, you know, privatised and outsourced social welfare nets. And so the reality is that the government does have some kind of a vision of expanding some provision of public services, albeit quite narrow, and that's what my larger dissertation looks at. I think the ethical concerns would be more about seeing this kind of data and not trying to think through how you could actually legitimise the provision of public services in a more effective way.
Have you considered Venezuela? I'm just not interested in the choice of Colombia, and given almost a failed state, I suppose you could describe it as, and what people's responses would be to this might be interesting in Caracas or something.
So, I wish I could give you a scientific answer as to why we've gone to Bogota. The real answer is Nestor is from Bogota.
Right.
So it's very easy to stay with his family and to do all this from Bogota, and he's got great contacts in the city. The issue with Caracas is just, I haven't been there since 2006, but the issue, I think, is just the plausibility of logistically of doing this quite a survey, which is, I mean, this is a really technically intensive thing to do in the field, because you have to train 30 enumerators for this, all on iPads, offline call treks. They're going to house in these colonias. I just don't think it would be safe, first of all, for me to do this. You'd be asking them questions that would be quite politically sensitive, and I just don't know whether it would be logistically possible, actually, to do it in Caracas. I think it would be very interesting, and so I think theoretically it would be great to do it in Caracas. But I just think logistically, I just don't think we'd be able to pull it off. I mean, there's one public opinion firm that I know of in Caracas, and they're now just reduced to using telephones. And the issue with that, of course, is that you get a crazy selection bias in your sample. But, yeah, I would love to do it.
Hello, thank you so much for the presentation. I have to say, I'm from Mexico.
Okay.
And it's a very accurate screenshot of attitudes from people to paying taxes, and also the general
sort of macroeconomic environment. My question for both of you would be, have you found this magical formula of breaking this negative tax loop? Or what would you think, especially now in Mexico, for instance, the population, I think in the last 24 years, social expenditure has tripled, and yet half of the, more than half of the population still live in poverty. So the results have not been seen, and even more so with decreasing taxes from the oil revenues. I see expenditure actually decreasing, and the population perceiving decreased social expenditure. So I don't know how to re-engage the population in a condition that is very precarious to begin with.
Well, I'm glad, first of all, that it's great to be in Mexico, and I hope I did your, I accurately portrayed your country. I'm a bit nervous about that. I am no expert in Mexican politics. And again, I'd like to give you a scientific reason as to why we went to Mexico. It was because we know the director of Beltrani Asociados very well, Leticia, and she's quite amazing in working, in being able to, she was extraordinary in having us to do this. I think the issue is in breaking this loop. Well, first of all, the spending has to be progressive. So it has to be progressive. So you can increase spending, but if that spending is just going to the same reasonably narrow or targeted groups, well, then I think it's just going to reinforce these types of perceptions. The place we do want to do this actually is in the past, because one thing that Evo Morales has done with the Movimiento al Socialismo is that they have expanded pensions. They have created a universal pension. So they have expanded pension coverage to the entire population, regardless of whether you're in the formal or informal sector. So there it could be quite interesting. And I think the second thing is for people to understand where the spending is going. So if there's a widespread, we've just even got this just in kind of informally. When we're talking to people in Mexico about this is what we're going to do, this is what we're interested in doing, and they would tell us, all the spending just goes to, it all just goes to specific groups, specific people. It doesn't really help anybody. It's hard. This group gets the union, get this, the teachers union get this, and this union get this. So there's this kind of perception that the spending is patronage driven or is very targeted. And I think if you can change that, if you can show people that A, it's progressive, and you inform people that this is what's going on, I don't have a magic bullet at all, but I think that would help. I think that's probably the first step. That's the best I have. Maybe Jared is a better solution.
Yeah, I agree with David. I think that the need to demonstrate tangible outcomes of social taxation is a really important aspect. And this is something that I actually did some workshops about this project with some parliamentarians and bureaucrats in Myanmar at national and provincial level back in 2016. And it's just really interesting because this campaign here was, I started off the presentation, it's like, what do we all think of this advertising around encouraging people to pay tax? And they're all like, it's wonderful, people don't know that it's their duty, and they need to know that it's their duty that they have to pay tax. And I said, well, does this tell anyone, when you see that, and so this is up in basically all major restaurants, for example, in Yangon, have this plastered on the wall, and it's linked to a consumption tax, a campaign to increase payment of that. And I said, well, what if you actually put an image of the beneficiary of that tax on that poster? Instead of emphasizing duty, you actually put a picture of, these are municipal taxes, for example, a rubbish bin or a rubbish truck, like something that's a very tangible, like, okay, this thing is actually, I see that I'm funding a public service. But you can't just be PR, right? You can't just redesign a poster. It's also got to be an institutional reform. And in Myanmar, especially the vast bulk of tax burden is basically going through five or six levels of accumulation at various levels of government before it goes all the way up to Naypyidaw, and then is redistributed through line ministries and allocated down to a township level where it's spent, right? So that's just, you're going out township, district, state, national, and then within that, you've got debates within budgetary processes, and it's just a very distant process. And especially in the context where you've got a legacy of military and authoritarian rule, that's really hard to overcome. So you've got to do the marketing, but you've also got to do institutional reforms that would, create stronger monitoring at various points of that process by people who are trusted. Yeah.
Right. I'm conscious of the time. I think there might still be a few questions, but I would like to formally end the seminar here, and perhaps a few people can stay a bit longer and ask a few more questions. Please join me and thank you too for the presentation. very business.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.